All right, let's turn to remarriage. Is remarriage a possibility? That is, marriage to a different person after divorce? That is a serious question with many people, of course. I think it's plain that there is remarriage not only allowed, but clearly allowed in the New Testament. 1 Corinthians 7, verses 27 and 28. In this section, Paul is talking about the impending crisis, verse 26. And he has said in that verse that he prefers, it's his view, he prefers for people to remain single. And I tried to explain that a little bit earlier. Whatever the crisis was he had in mind, some persecution, some awful thing coming upon the church, better not to have the church grow up in situations where wives and children would be deprived of husbands and all the terrible things that would happen to families, particularly in that crisis. Remember, Jesus had concern about families too when he talked about the destruction of Jerusalem. That same concern was there. And he said, pray that your flight won't be in winter, you know. And then he also talked about giving nurse to children and so on. That would be rough. Well, here it is. It's my view that it's well for a person to remain in the state in which he is. Don't go starting to change a lot of things now because you've got a lot of other stuff to handle that's going to take priority in your life. And then he begins to work out that principle a little bit. Are you bound to a wife? Don't seek to be released. Well, how did you get released? He's talking about divorce in the early part of the chapter. That's obviously what he's talking about here again. Have you been released from a wife? Luo is the verb, loosed, released, luo. A lot of different words used for divorce in the Bible. We've got to recognize that. And so he says, have you been released from a wife? Don't seek a wife. You've already been divorced, then don't go around seeking a wife. But now, just as he says with the virgin later on, if the father doesn't give his virgin daughter in marriage, he does well, and I advise him not to, unless he thinks he's doing the wrong thing for her in certain circumstances. Well, let her go ahead and be married, and there's no sin under those circumstances. Now, he concedes again here that under these circumstances, it would be better in this crisis situation not to be married if you've been divorced. But he goes on to say, have you been released from a wife? Don't seek a wife. But if you do marry, there is no sin in doing so. Now he says that to two classes of people he's been talking to. The person who isn't bound to begin with, but he has just finished saying the person who has been released from a wife. Better for that person who has been divorced not to seek a wife, but if he does marry, the person who has been released from a wife, if he does marry, there is no sin in doing so. I think that's as clear, as straightforward a statement as you can find anywhere. And it's interesting the way he puts it. Now, of course, he doesn't mean to speak to the issue directly. He speaks to it indirectly because his main point in the passage is saying that I want you to stay single if you can under these crisis circumstances. But it's very interesting that he even, under those circumstances, and I think this reinforces and even strengthens the argument, that even under those very cases of stringency where he advises not getting married at all, he still even permits a divorced person to get married without sin under those circumstances. So the idea of remarriage after divorce being always wrong and never allowed or always a sinful thing and so on is straightforwardly contradicted in this passage. That idea never was biblical and it just cannot be maintained to be biblical. The time we sat down on it hard, said what the Bible says about it and not minced words. The bill of divorce, both the Hebrew and the Greek bills of divorce, and by the way, if you want to go to the Loeb Classical Library and pick out the papyri, the volumes on papyri, the volume on papyri that has all of the marriage and divorce contracts in it, you'll see contract after contract in the Greek divorces as well as in the Hebrew divorces, which I read for you. The divorce clearly says you're free to marry any man. Both contracts. Those are the ones that are being used. Both those divorce contracts. That sort. Every one of them says that as one of the key factors in the process. Now, there are other issues, of course, that arise. The question is, what about the guilty party as well as the innocent party? And Murray, I think, has done a remarkable piece of work on that issue. He maintains, at the cost of friends, that the guilty party, when forgiven by Christ, also has the right to remarry. I don't think he goes into the when forgiven. I'd like to add that element, because I don't think anybody is qualified to marriage until he's straight before marriage, until he's straight with God and with his neighbor. Without anything in the past that would get in the way of the marriage, that would be a problem of marriage qualifications in the first place if he had never married before. I'd like to add that element. That a person always has to consider his life. Is he prepared for marriage? Is he ready for marriage? And of course, there are lots of questions that arise about a person who's been through a divorce. Has he become soured on marriage through this divorce? Did he learn all the wrong things about marriage? Is he a bad bet for another marriage? I mean, the way he is right now. I mean, all those qualifying questions you ask for a person who's going to be married. Anyway, all the premarital counseling questions come in here, too, and maybe with a vengeance come in here, because so often people get wrong habits and attitudes and all the rest about marriage having gone through a thing poorly the first time. And so many of these people who get married, remarried, do a very poor piece of work in getting remarried. But that's a secondary question to the main one that we're asking. Do they have the right? Yes, they have the right, the scriptures affirm, if the person has the basic qualifications for marriage anyway. You say, where do the scriptures affirm the right of the guilty party, the one who was guilty, to remarry? Well, the scriptures affirm it incidentally. They do not affirm it directly. They talk about the forgiveness that we've been speaking about in this passage and others in 1 Corinthians 6, 9 to 11 and elsewhere. And adultery is one of the things that is forgiven. Don't forget. And if what God has forgiven, we have no right to raise issues about. And Murray makes the point that the guilty party is nowhere forbidden to remarry, and that the divorce contract always maintained remarriage as an essential element in it, and that if there were an exception, it would have had to have been clearly stated in the context in which this was said, both in the Greek context, Roman context, and in the Jewish context, because that was what was understood. Bettner meets the thing that's bothering you right now in his comments, in his little pamphlet. What's bugging you this moment, he says, is this. You hear somebody say such things as this, and he maintains that what Murray says is true also. He says, what you really want is to punish that person a little more. He says, that's why it's bugging you. You think they're getting off too easy. You think after all the hurt, after all the damage, after all the heartaches and sorrows that rupture brought into so many people's lives and the disgrace that it brought to the name of Christ, that you just got to add something more to it. You just got to do something there to maybe make him stand off at arm's length for in the cold with his feet without shoes and socks in the snow for a while at least. The Bible doesn't teach it, says Bettner. It says Murray. I think you've got to agree. doesn't teach it. It teaches forgiveness. That's why forgiveness is hard. It's one of the reasons why forgiveness is hard. Jesus in Luke 17 says, somebody comes to you seven times a day and says, I repent. After he's hit you in the nose seven times a day, by the way, he sinned against you, he's talking about. You must forgive him. That's hard. That's not easy. That's hard. Forgiveness is hard. We don't forgive easily. Oh, we say, oh, yeah, I'll forgive you if you, repent and seek forgiveness, I'll forgive you. Well, that's not too easy the first time he's hit you very hard in the nose, but when he's come back 5 minutes later and hit you again after you've forgiven him. And when he comes back 5 minutes later and hits you once again after you've forgiven him twice, and after he's come back and hitting you again after you've forgiven him three or four or five times or six times, Jesus said if he hits you seven times in the nose on the same day and seven times returned saying, not demonstrating any change, but saying on his naked raw word, there's no opportunity to look for fruit, you see, on the first day. You just got to watch fists. You must forgive him. Forgiveness is hard. Now, I'm not saying this is easy, and your people are not going to find that word easy. Forgiveness is so hard that it required a cross. Now, this does not minimize sin. It maximizes the Savior. I want to say that again. Sounds like we're talking about loose things. People can do things in all kinds of ways and get away with it and all that. Nobody got away with anything. It hurt everybody involved. The repercussions of that and the punishment and the penalty of that fell upon Jesus Christ. Nobody got away with anything. So let's be real clear in our thinking as we talk to one another. Even if there's still something down inside of us, an attitude that's born out of long-standing teaching that we now no longer can hold to because we want to be faithful to the Scriptures and we still feel a little uneasy with what the Scriptures say as this other thing continues to work on us, and because of this natural desire to want to get that guy for what he did to that woman or get that woman for what she did to those children, you've got to realize that's part of the hardness, hard task of forgiving people. Now, I just want to leave that fester with you a little bit, worry you a little bit, because I believe that's just where it ought to work, down deep inside on you, to see what forgiveness is really all about. The right of remarriage, then, exists, and we have to maintain it among people. Let me say about attitudes. Your attitude is going to ring through in everything you do and say. When you preach about these subjects, when you minister to people who are involved, you have kind of a distaste in your mouth for these people who have been involved in this divorce and remarriage and all that kind of thing. They're going to feel it. They're going to sense it. They're going to recognize it. And I don't say you have to get rid of all of that all overnight and all right away. But one thing that'll help you more than anything else, and one thing that'll temper it immediately, and one thing that they can sense along with perhaps some revulsion that's proper, is if you have a sense of compassion and a real sense of forgiveness. Now, those are things to cultivate. What the promise of forgiveness can do to a person when he really begins to keep that, make that promise and keep it. You see, you begin not by trying to feel a different way, but you begin by actually doing things that are hard for you to do. That's what Jesus said in that Luke 17 context. He said it's like a slave who goes out and he works all day long under the hot sun and sweats. And he's been out there in the field or he's been with the cattle all day or the sheep or something. And he comes in, he's hungry as he can be when he comes in. And he is tired and he's sweaty and he stinks. He says, what does the Lord do when he sees a slave come in that way at the end of the day? Does he look at him and say, oh, you're tired, you're sweaty, and you stink? Go get a shower and change your clothes and sit down and rest and have something to eat. Not on your life, says Jesus. Against all the man's feelings, Jesus tells that guy, get out of those dirty, filthy, smelly clothes, and you get into that kitchen and you make my meal, and don't you eat a bite of it. You make my meal, and you come back and you serve it to me, though you're as hungry and as tired as you can be, you serve it to me, and when I'm finished toying with the last peel on my plate, then you go get my dessert, you bring that, and you let your mouth water, and you stand there watching me eat that dessert while you're standing there with a towel hanging over one arm, watching it with all his eyes like saucer, and it's already, instead of looking like a dessert, it looks like cliffs of apricot over which are cascading Niagara's of whipped cream. And then, when I've finished eating, then, and then only, you go back and get something for yourself, and then you rest. In other words, you do this thing whether you feel like it or not. When you don't feel like it. And that's what we have to do with forgiveness. That's the way to start changing, and that's the way we have to start people changing. Get them to know what the scriptures say, and then say you must do it. But if you do it long enough, and you see the good results of God's work in people's lives and the blessing that comes, your feelings begin to change after a while. You begin to understand what it means that Jesus Christ forgave people who were driving nails into his hand and said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." There was compassion in that remark. Compassion. That's what comes through. The compassion that brings him to ask forgiveness for driving nails through him, for putting crowns of thorns on his head, for lacerating his back with a cat of nine tails. That's the compassion that we've got to develop, and you don't develop it without doing the hard thing in spite of your feelings that turn you off. You say, "I'd be a hypocrite if I do this when I don't feel like it." No, that's not so. You're a hypocrite if you say you feel like it, and you do it when you don't feel like it. But you're never a hypocrite for doing what God commands you to do when you don't feel like it. You're just responsible. And the interesting thing is that forgiveness is a promise. It's first, it's not a feeling first. It's a promise that you can make and that you can keep even when you don't feel like it. Your wife says to you, "Will you take me out on Friday?" And this is Monday, let's say. And you say, "Oh, yeah, I'll be glad to take you out on Friday." That's far enough away, you don't have to worry about it too much now on Monday. But Friday comes, and it's been an awful week. And Friday itself was the worst day of the week, and you come home with a headache and a throbbing temple, and you come home with a briefcase stuffed full of work that profs gave to you, and you come home, and the last thing you want to do is to go out for supper. But you made a promise, and you'd better to keep it, whether you feel like it or not. And you can keep it whether you feel like it or not. And you know, maybe 99 times out of 100, if you do keep it, you feel better in the end. You do kind of get into the spirit of the thing after all. You act against your feelings all the time. We live in a feeling-oriented age where people say, "If I don't follow my feelings, I'll be a hypocrite." That's an unbiblical view of hypocrisy. It's simply responsibility on your part to do what God says to do, whether you feel like it or not. Hypocrisy is misrepresenting your feelings to another, saying, "Oh, I have no trouble forgiving you." You might have to honestly say the first 5 or 6 times before you begin to get this sense of compassion, "This is hard to do, but I believe Jesus Christ wants me to do it. I believe it's the right thing to do, and I'll do it." Forgiveness is a promise that you can make when you don't feel like it, and that you can keep. You promise you're not going to raise the issue, you're not going to hold it against the person, you're not going to make it an issue anymore. That's forgiveness. You know, this is a wonderful thing to have clear and plain in our thinking. And we've got to develop it in this area as well as in every other area. And I'm just making a plea for forgiveness and for an active, realistic, genuine kind of forgiveness that leads to compassion. Okay, let's go on. When you qualify a person for marriage, there are many questions that arise. These are questions that you want to ask a person talking about remarriage who has been divorced, just the same as you would talk about anybody else. For example, are they Christians is the basic question always. Have they sought reconciliation is a very vital question here. It may very well be that two people come to you who are in no position to remarry because one of them or both of them has an obligation to somebody else, and for you to marry them in this situation would lead to countenancing adultery and actually effecting it by that remarriage to other parties. Has fornication been committed and has it been forgiven? Has some sexual sin been committed and has that been forgiven? If there was a divorce, has there been something in and around the process of obtaining that divorce that was wrong that needs to be dealt with? Did the parties get into some awful row and were terrible things said and were awful things done? Are there matters that yet need to be straightened out of that sort? Even though the divorce might stand, are there things that need to be repented of before God and the person needs to go back and seek forgiveness for in the very process and the things that went on in that process? I don't believe the person's qualified to move into something new until he's cleaned up the rubble of the past, whatever it is. I'm not saying this is easy. I'm saying all these things have to be dealt with. You don't just go sailing blissfully into the next situation without considering all that went on first. And in the divorce itself, were the terms of the divorce, because you've got a shyster lawyer who you were going to get in there to punish that guy or punish that other person for what they'd done to you, and he went in there and he really ripped and cut and snorted and went after that other person and gouged them for everything he could conceivably drain out of their veins. And he got it all, and it's in a bottle on your shelf today. And the other person's going around anemic, getting what little blood transfusions other people can give to him. And you did it all to him. Was that right? No, it wasn't right. And maybe you better think of a new kind of settlement. There are things that need to be done often before you're ready to move on. You've got a past. And unless that past is where it belongs, namely in the past, buried, dealt with, and cleaned up, the mess cleaned up as best possible, then I don't think you're ready to move on in the future yet. All these kinds of questions by pastors ought to be asked and ought to be dealt with. So we're not just saying, oh yeah, the person's eligible for divorce, period, exclamation point, forget all the past. God's forgiven it. Sure, he's forgiven it, but forgiveness does not mean that the consequences of that act can't also yet remain until they are dealt with. The questions that you normally ask people, I've listed some of those things in Shepherding God's Flock, Volume 2, pages 81 following. The normal kinds of questions for qualifying people for marriage ought also to be asked here. And let us not forget that wrong views of marriage, wrong views of persons, wrong views of sex, wrong views of roles are almost always present in people who have been divorced. Divorce means a failure has occurred. A failure has occurred. And the party that you're dealing with, or the parties you're dealing with, must learn, and you must help them to learn by investigating it with them, not in order to punish or anything else, but in order to ensure the new marriage as a success rather than a failure, and honoring God and really exemplifying that relationship of Christ to his church. It is absolutely essential for you to help those people to discover how they contributed to the failure. Now, they may have been the ones who did the wrong thing or not the ones who did the wrong thing in the basic obtaining of the divorce, but they almost always in a divorce situation where two sinners have been involved, there is not all one-sided, but everybody has done something wrong. Now, somebody's divorced you when they shouldn't have. You didn't do the basic thing wrong, but you may have been an awful person to live with. You certainly may have had an awful lot of wrong ideas, and you've still got all that, and the divorce process didn't help straighten it out, usually. It usually creates new and different problems itself. So how did you contribute to the problems in that home that led to a divorce, and what are you like now, and are you really qualified? Divorced people, the statistics show, tend to remarry. And there are tons of divorced people around here. More of them remarry than don't, and more divorced people per so many heads of cattle or whatever it is marry than undivorced people. So the divorced people tend to remarry. You're going to have to face this in the church when you go out, and you better be aware of some of these principal and key factors. Now, it's not always true. Maybe the person's done a remarkable job of cleaning up the past, of rethinking the question. You may have spent hours of dedicated Bible study and prayer and reoriented his priorities and his life and everything else. And well, that's wonderful. You got a freebie. But that's not the average one that comes down the pike when you start working. Every once in a while, God sends you one like that and gives you a reprieve. But most of the time, you're going to have to work long and work hard with these people. And if they say, well, you're taking too much time, we want to do this right away, you can point out that's one of the very reasons why they're going to fail again and why you won't go ahead until they have taken the time to deal with the issue. That can be a mighty good sign of the problem, this business of impatience in the light of matters that need to get squared away. Divorce itself, the process of divorce, is something you often will find yourself going through with one or more of the parties. Of course, you will try to seek reconciliation where it ought to be sought and so on, but there are times when the divorce itself is going to go through and you don't agree that it shouldn't go through. You agree that this is one of those unfortunate situations where I suppose it falls into the categories. Now, a divorce is never anything but a crisis. It is a crisis, sometimes far more disruptive in people's lives in general than a death could be. A death, you see, is a very natural thing in many circumstances. That's why when Lindemann studied the Coconut Grove fire and set forth the first series of studies on crisis, counseling, and everybody followed his lead thereafter, that it was a very poor kind of situation in which to develop the basic principles of grief. Because the people who were grieving after the Coconut Grove fire tragedies, where all those people died, and he went around and studied the loved ones who were grieving, were people who were taken unaware. And it was a sudden and catastrophic kind of thing. And that is not necessarily the way that everybody faces grief. A lot of people grieve with the dying person when it's old age and natural death, or it's been a long period of time and they come adjusting slowly and quickly. And there's a lot of things involved there. And of course, the grief also that takes place among Christians who face death as they should is different from that among unbelievers, Paul says in 1 Thessalonians, or should be. So it is with this matter here. Grief, you see, is what often happens in a divorce. I noticed they're opening the door on me. I didn't realize I was so late again. We'll have to take just a little bit more time tomorrow and then go into Q&A. Bring your questions. We'll give you lots of time. As we begin today, I would like to read you a letter that I received, which is typical, I think, of the kind of thing that I have been getting for many years now. Many, many letters like this, and I want to give you a feel for the kinds of problems that you'll be facing. I think this letter speaks for itself. I am writing you in reference to a major decision that must be made concerning my life's work. And he says a few things that identify where he is and all that, and I'll drop that. And I've scratched a few other things in the letter, too, to keep identification out. This is my problem. Prior to entering college, I married a dedicated Christian girl, a leader in the Youth for Christ meeting, such and such a place. I had been working with such and such a group with drug addicts and other teenage problems, along with speaking frequently at numerous high schools, colleges, and civic organizations on the danger and effect of drugs. After our honeymoon, we moved to Blank, where I attended Blank while she worked full-time. After a semester, I too began to work and eventually began working full-time also. After 2 years, we moved to Blank, where I transferred to Blank, majoring in theology, pastoral psychology. My wife filed for divorce on grounds of incompatibility about a year and a half later. For 8 months, we had been attending weekly counseling by one of my professors, who also was our co-pastor. Upon his advice, I counterfiled for reconciliation and marriage counseling. After numerous hearings, depositions, etc., etc., which continued for 7 long months, the trial was set on June 29, 1976. The trial lasted from 9:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. The judge granted the divorce. My question is, being a born-again Christian, I find it increasingly difficult to be accepted within most evangelical churches. Even more frustrated, and solely due to the divorce issue, I am not permitted to preach, lecture, or even teach Sunday school. I would like to be a family counselor, but I would like your counsel as to whether or not I would be accepted, even if I had the proper degree and credentials due to my divorce. Please tell it to me straight, because I wouldn't be accepted. If I wouldn't be accepted, then I must make the decision to enter law or some other discipline. Now, that's the situation where a lot of people are, and all through that letter, there are problems. I haven't time to exegete it and comment on it in all details, but I'd just like to point out 3 or 4 things. First of all, here is counseling that goes on in this situation for 8 months. I haven't time to exegete it and comment on it in all details, but I'd just like to point out 3 or 4 things. First of all, here is counseling that goes on in this situation for 8 months. 8 months of counseling. Something was wrong with that counseling to begin with. And we see one of the things that was wrong with that counseling. And the counselor advises the man to counterfile for reconciliation and marriage counseling. He advises nothing about the church. Here he allowed legal action to be taken before ever getting the thing into the courts of the church. So, first of all, the counseling probably wasn't biblical, or if it was, it was extremely feeble. Secondly, if it took 8 months, this matter should have been dealt with, whatever the details of it were, in 10 weeks or less, probably 8, if there was satisfactory counseling. And certainly there should have been the Church of Jesus Christ at work in this matter along with it, and that doesn't even get into the picture here. And then when the fellow is divorced, after the church has muffed the ball and God's people have muffed the ball in counseling him, and he did everything he could to keep the divorce from occurring. Of course, we know nothing about the particulars. He may have been greatly at fault in many ways, but she, no matter how much he was in fault, should not have divorced him if she didn't have adequate grounds, which, if this is true, she didn't. And then we see that everybody rejects him. The church won't help him, but then the church rejects him. You get the picture, don't you? The church doesn't come to play at the first and really work hard at disciplining and caring and working on the problems. Only one individual tries with what he has, which isn't very effective. And then the church says, we don't want any part of it. That's what's been going on. This letter's just typical. I just pulled it out of the mess before I came up here, out of a whole mess of letters like this I have. I just grabbed one, practically. I did thumb through 2 or 3, and this one seemed to have some of the elements. And it's just typical of all kinds of things that are happening today. And this is why I'm talking about this subject. And I don't have all the answers. And today when you ask me questions, you'll realize I don't have all the answers. And there's some problems about what I've been teaching you so far. And they're not all resolved for me any more than they are for you. But we've got to be working hard at this, and we've got to nail a few things down tightly, and we've got to get to work on those and work where we can and continue to work at this problem. And I hope all of you, this is my last plea to you here, I hope all of you will continue on, even if you disagree with me at points. I hope you will have been stirred about the problem, and you will be stirred about the fact that the Scriptures have got to have the answer. Even if that guy up there who was struggling with them, I don't agree with on every point, I see he was working in the scriptures and he was trying to get the answers, and I'll help him out by really sharpening him up later on in this way and that way, and maybe I can take off from some of the things that he stirred up in my mind and really get the answers even though he didn't have them. I don't care how you view it, so long as it drives you back to the Word of God to come up with answers and not to let this matter slide. Because this is all too important, and this is happening all too often. On both ends of the stick, before the fact and after the fact, the church misses the boat. That's where it's been missing it, all the way down the line. Both ends of the stick. And I hope there'll be at least one graduating class of Westminster Theological Seminary, or two, whatever you represent, or three or five, some of you, I guess, who will go out of here with some concern for this matter. And whatever you need to do about it, improve, junk what I had to say, accept it, buy it, do whatever you're going to do with it, you'll do something, and something very definitive and biblical. Some of us have spread ourselves so thin trying to meet the needs of people in all kinds of areas that we can't do everything. And my greatest appeal is to get you concerned and get you working. Now, I want to see some work come out of this bunch right here. I didn't come up here to this cold north and get my car all frozen up over there so it won't even ride. Run, and if you, by the way, if you know how I can get it unfrozen, I'd appreciate it. I've called all the Datsun dealers, and they don't know. They've got too many other ones frozen to get take care of mine. And I don't know anybody who can do anything with fuel injections. The Gulf Station shakes its head, and so do the other people down the road. So if you've got any answers, or you are the answer, please let me know. But I can come all the way up here and get my car frozen up and my nose frozen off and the rest of it, just to play games here during these 2 weeks. I came here to get you concerned. Even if I don't have all the answers, maybe you will. And may God bless you as you work at it. And may God move you to work at it. And out of this group, may there come some definitive pieces of some definitive material. And I hope that I'll hear from you. Not just today, but I mean over the days to come, as you ponder and think about these things, and you take your list, which is not an academic exercise, I hope you appreciated, as you worked on this, the fact that it's a hard job to handle those principles and to know what to really write down in terms of principles. I hope you struggled, and I hope you had a rough job with it, so that you could see where the problems lie. But I also hope it raised the problems for you, and I hope you'll continue to take your copy of that list and refine it 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 until you've got something workable. So that when the next guy comes down the pike struggling and having a rough time, confused and not knowing which way to go, and open to your counsel, your counsel will at least stem from the Scriptures. And you won't advise him to go get a lawyer or in response or something of that sort. And your church will be ready to move in and do something quickly before it's too late. The church is always there too late with too little, and usually the wrong thing even then. And that's what this letter says. And I hope your church, wherever God puts you to minister in the days to come, will be one that isn't too late with too little and with the wrong thing. Now, that's my burden in coming here. This is not an academic course only. It's a concern about people in ministry. In days to come, it's a concern about those people to whom you're going to minister. I hope if you remember back to the next divorce case that you have to handle, if it's 3, 4, 2, 1, or a half years from now, wherever you might be, if you remember back to this course where you struggled your head off in 2 weeks to get some principles together and run three cases through them, and you'll be glad that you did it. At that point, and the other people will thank God that you did it, not knowing what you did, but thank God for the fact that you were ready, at least to some extent, to meet their problems on some level from the Word of God. Okay, now that's what it's been all about here, and I'm not going to go any further into lecturing. I'm going to let you have the floor after I read you a couple questions. Somebody handed me about 16 questions. It wouldn't be fair to take all 16 of his and not hear yours, but I'll start with his questions and take a few of them anyway. And then we'll let you come into the picture from there on in. He did the job of writing them out and handing them to me, so I'll start with him. Here's one. Should the church officers interfere in a marriage they know to be breaking up unless asked by one of the parties? The word interfere is not a word you can use with reference to church officers doing the job of looking into people's lives. And that's my response. In Hebrews, the last chapter, we read about the elders of the church in verse 17 of chapter 13, in which the scriptures say, "Obey your leaders and submit to them." By the way, very few people have ever been taught that in the church. If a pastor were to come along and say to a member of the church, "Hey, you've got to stop doing so and so, and you ought to be doing thus and so," most members of a congregation in this country, at least today, would say, "Who are you to tell me what I'm to do or not to be doing?" Or at least that would be their attitude if they didn't say it in so many words. Well, that isn't to be the attitude of a member of the Church of Jesus Christ to an elder. There's more about it in Thessalonians, and there's more about it in Peter. But right here it says, obey your leaders and submit to them. But that isn't the point I want to make. That's just a sideline. Goes on to say, they are keeping watch over you as men who will have to give an account. The episcopoi, those bishops, or those who inspect, those inspectors, those watchkeepers over the flock, those who oversee as a shepherd oversees, and the word episkopos never simply has the idea of any old kind of overseer, but it usually is used in conjunction, Acts 20 and in the Peter passages, with overseeing as a shepherd oversees. Like Christ is the great episkopos and namely the shepherd of your souls. They keep watch over the flock like those shepherds kept watch over the flock at night. Sitting up around that fire, you know, the Christmas story. Well, the Christmas story is very instructive. They were keeping watch over their flocks. And that's what a shepherd's to do, and that's what every elder is to do. And that's what we see here they are doing. They are keeping watch over you as men who will have to give an account. God's going to call every shepherd to account someday, and he's going to say, were you alert? Were you watching? Were you looking? Were you keeping watch over the flock that God has put in your charge, as Paul puts it in Acts 20 when he talks to the Ephesian elders. He says, have you been alert to the forces that come in from outside to destroy the flock, or to the forces that grow up within that would destroy the flock from inside? Look out for both and be alert and be ready to meet these forces like a shepherd is ready to meet any kind of destructive force that may come into the flock. Now, are you alert and are you ready? That's what he's saying to you and to me and to our elders of our churches. And so the answer to this question is, it's not interfering when a shepherd or when an elder moves in when he sees something disturbing the flock or members of it. That's not interfering. That's fulfilling the charge that God has laid upon him. Now, there is a distinction here to be made between elders who are assigned the task of keeping flock and members who are assigned the task of keeping their noses out of other people's business. The scriptures also teach in the letter to the Thessalonians, I won't go around spending a lot of time with that, these idle people who were poking their noses into everybody else's business were called busybodies. And so you don't go around looking for problems if you're a member of the church. You do go around watching out for problems if you're an elder or a shepherd in the church. Those two jobs are to be distinguished. Now, the members, Galatians 6, 1 and 2 says, if you stumble over a problem, then you become involved. But you don't go around looking for a problem. You get that difference. The elders do both. If they stumble over them, they're involved, but they're also involved to keep a sharp eye out for problems, to be alert, so that they can nip them in the bud and save people a lot of heartache and sorrow. So the answer to this one is very clear. Yes, if one party asks you, you go to work. Yes, if nobody asks you, you go to work. If you see something that you believe is wrong in that situation, you may be wrong about it, but if you've offered your help in the right way, people can't be upset. If they are upset, then there's something wrong with them, and they did have a problem anyway. That was it. So they need ministry either way. All right, now one or two more off of this sheet. What would you say to someone who thought today's conditions are like 1 Corinthians 7 and therefore does not marry? I'd say you, of course, have a right to evaluate the circumstances around you. And it may very well be, if you're in a different culture and country and circumstance, that your condition may very well be like those circumstances to which Paul was addressing himself in Corinth. I don't think that in this country, right now, at this moment in 1978, that we have those kinds of conditions, though I'm not a prophet. Paul didn't have them at the moment. He saw an impending disaster, an impending crisis coming, and as a prophet, he saw that. I'm not a prophet, nor the son of a prophet. And I can't see impending things very well. They have to be pretty close to the, they can't be very far off on the horizon for me, because I just don't have that kind of prophetic insight that he had. But if the clouds are up there and the things are very, very dark, and the lightning is flashing, I kind of get the idea. Now, when it comes to that point, I could speak about the impending crisis that's about, that's on the way. And then I could talk in those terms. But I'm not sure I have the same prophetic insight that Paul does. Maybe this other individual is better off in that respect than I. He may have X-ray vision or something into the horizon. You said in the Bible we have no marriage ceremony. What do you consider Jacob's marriage to Leah to be, where she was brought to him? And what of Revelation 19, verses 1 to 10? Yeah, it says that she was brought to him in Genesis 29, 28, and so on, and talks about entering into the sexual relations, and talks about the wedding banquet there, and also about the wedding banquet in Revelation 19. But in neither of those places are there any words of ceremony. Words of the ceremony. That's what I was talking about. I didn't mean that there weren't references to weddings or references to the fact that there was some kind of a gathering that took place. Of course there are, and that's why I would be so anxious to know what the ceremony was really like, but we never get the exact words of a ceremony. That's what I was talking about when I said ceremony. If you mean by ceremony all the banqueting and all the good times they had and all that kind of thing, yeah, sure, there's plenty of that. That's what you always read about. But the marriage feast of the Lamb and all that. But no words of a marriage ceremony, such as I blank take thee blank to be my lawfully wedded wife or husband or something. See? And none of that is what I was talking about. Maybe one more here. Let's see. On what grounds do you say that 1 Corinthians 7, 10 to 11 deal with Christians? What is there in the text? Well, I say it on the ground that when Paul comes down to verse 12, is it? That he distinguishes and sets over against 10 and 11 the situation where you have a believer and an unbeliever. So the only thing that distinguishes what follows from what comes before is the fact that what before must have been believers because what comes afterward is not a believer and a believer. And that's what makes it a special category or special group over against, distinguishable from, and different in advice from what he is discussing in 10 and 11. It's an argument that most people have found very sound and satisfactory in the passage. I don't think there's much disagreement on that point among the commentators anywhere. And that's, of course, how we reach that conclusion. But I appreciate you asking the question so that we could have that chance to say so. Your question is, how does a man, is it possible for a man to treat his wife as though she's not his wife, 1 Corinthians 7? You mean, I want you to be as if you were not married. All those, right, I got you now. I was thinking about the earlier verses. You mean, let's see here, verse 29 and thereafter. That's the passage you're referring to. Thank you. What I am trying to tell you, brothers, verse 29, is this. The time is short. From now on, let those who have wives be like those who have none. Those who weep like those who don't weep. Those who rejoice like those who don't rejoice, and those who buy like those who have nothing, and those who use the world like those who abuse it. The shape of things in this world is giving way. Now, I don't understand all the particulars in any given situation. They would differ. But as I gather those words, and I read all of them, because I think as a whole they give us the flavor of what he's saying more readily than to take and abstract any one of them from it, although you must abstract each one of them from it and then try to work out the details in a given situation. But just to look at it as a whole without trying to get into details, because we don't know the particulars of that situation, what it means is, as I understand it, simply this. A lot of the things that you would do under more settled conditions will have to be foregone. You might have a lot more leisurely time together. You might find that you might be able to deal with issues at your own leisure, which now will come crowding upon you to make decisions about that you're going to have to make decisions about immediately, and there's no way that you can wait to make those decisions. There will be things that you and she might do in decorating your home, just to give a particular or so, that you'll just forget about now. Homes won't mean very much, and houses won't mean very much in those days when they're going to burn them down around you. Using the things of the world, for example, fits into this picture. You're not going to even be able to plan to have that little garden maybe that the two of you were planning on having, and so on. You've got to change your priorities, is what it really boils down to. And the change of the priorities means that many of the things that you would want to do for your wife, you're going to have to neglect. In any crisis situation, that's what happens. Now, it does not mean that you ever develop the attitude, well, I can neglect her. But many of the things that you would do normally for her, you would neglect. Now the things you do for her will be of a different order, will be of a different sort. They will not be the kinds of homemaking things, the kind of picnicking things, the kind, you know, the family-type things that you might in a more normal situation make as big priorities. Maybe now, I don't know what might be involved particularly, but there's going to be a lot less relaxed situation, and you're going to have to change all those priorities. Not neglect her, but what you do for her is going to be quite different from what you would normally do for her. All right, the question is, what do you do with children involved in a divorce? And I wish I had good answers to that. One of the big problems, of course, is our culture and the law. Particularly does the problem become acute when you have a Christian father and a non-Christian mother. Divorce occurs and the woman takes the children, and the husband, who knows Christ, now no longer has the influence that he can bring to bear upon those children, except at very minimal opportunities that he has to visit them, which are stated by the law or something of the sort. I think you do every conceivable thing you can at those times. You continue to bear whatever responsibilities that you can bear. You do a lot of praying. You try to bring other factors and other people into the situation who might be more acceptable than you are, who were family friends who did have the gospel, perhaps, and churches that did have some influence, perhaps. You do everything you can. But it's a messy, terrible situation, and that's exactly what's involved here in 1 Corinthians 7. That's recognized as such. The unbelieving husband is sanctified by his wife. The unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean. Now they're holy. Man, that's what he's talking about. He sees the problem too. If that home gets broken up, then the children suffer. That's what he's saying. I don't care what you read into those words, it shows suffering on the part of the children. That's one serious reason for opposing divorce, as he says here, even with an unbeliever. You do everything you can to never get to that point, and everything you can to win them. So There's no good answer to it. None given in the text. It's a messy, divorce is a messy, horrible thing. No wonder God says, I hate divorce. Sorry, I haven't got a better answer. The question is, does the Old Testament concept of defilement carry over into the New Testament law? I'm not sure that the Old Testament idea of defilement is something we today have in our New Testament economy. Is that the idea? I was making the point that I believe that the defilement spoken of here was that he caused her, as Jesus said, to commit adultery. Now, you might ask also, there's a further problem that nobody yet has asked, and I'll ask it myself because I don't have the answer to it either, since we're not getting the things that are tough to answer here. Well, then if she is defiled in the sense of committing adultery, why wasn't she put to death? Or he's defiled, or why wasn't she and her husband put to death for adultery at that point? I don't quite understand that. I think I have an answer to it, but I'm not ready to give it. But yes, I would say, from what I was maintaining yesterday, that in the light of light of Matthew 5, Matthew 19, Mark 10, and Luke 16, all of which are talking about that Deuteronomy passage, but particularly Matthew 5, where it speaks of her causing her to commit adultery, that is the most reasonable explanation of the passage, that this causes her a defilement in that case, in that instance, in that situation. And if it causes her defilement in that situation, then Jesus is reintroducing the problem and the situation, in fact, even clarifying it for us today and clarifying it for his kingdom, since that's the Sermon on the Mount in which he is giving the laws of his kingdom, straightening out the misinterpretations that exist of the Old Testament law, modifying and changing and updating and also clarifying what his people are to know and to learn and to do within his kingdom in the days to come. So I would see that the thing does carry over. And I think also that it's in view in 1 Corinthians 7, 10, and 11, where it says, remain unmarried. And, of course, you could explain that otherwise, but there's a strong inference in my judgment that if you go ahead and remarry, you are in trouble. And that would, of course, bear upon your question previous to this one, if that inference is true. But we can't really firmly establish that. What are the grounds? Thank you. What are the grounds for a divorce and remarriage among two unbelievers? I get to thinking about the question and about the answer, not the question. And how does a pastor relate to it? Most of the time, you don't have to relate to it because they don't care what you think about it and don't seek your advice. So fortunately, that's where you are most of the time. However, later on you may get to the problem in some secondary way when they become believers, or one of them does, or something like that. I see no reason saying that the laws that apply to a believer are not also applicable to an unbeliever, but that when you have the mixed condition, there is a further question that applies. And whether that further instance applies also to two unbelievers is the only question in doubt. It seems as if the basic position is that fornication is a ground for divorce for all people, even though it's spoken specifically to believers. But the question is, does the 1 Corinthians 7:15 passage, that's the real nub of the issue, it seems, apply to two unbelievers? And the question there is, the answer there is, it seems to me, probably yes. You have to make inferences on all these. That's why I have to keep guarding statements by words like probably. The reason being that the same difficulties exist with two unbelievers that exist with a believer and an unbeliever, only they're even worse. That is, you don't have the care and the discipline of the church and the resources that you have. Remember, I mentioned those things that Romans 12:18 says in terms of a believer trying to get an unbeliever to do something, to be reconciled with. You don't have the resources for reconciliation. between a believer and unbeliever. All you can do is have a one-sided situation there, Romans 12:18. Well, here you have not even a one-sided situation. You have a no-sided situation where neither one of them has any resources to draw upon for real reconciliation and real understanding of forgiveness. They don't obey the Scriptures. They don't have the Spirit of God dwelling within them. They have nothing, nothing, nothing. That really means real reconciliation is possible in the sense of not just coming back together again and saying, I forgive you, oh, it's okay, yeah, let's try again. But the idea of really rebuilding something on a new basis. See, which is what's really involved in reconciliation in the Scriptures. When we're reconciled to God, it's not just a matter of forgiving our past. But it's a matter of a whole new relationship on a whole new, wholly new basis in which God himself now builds the new relationship that he requires. Christ just doesn't say, I've got you forgiven and that's the end, everything's finished. But he says, now I'm going to do a lot of work in you, and I'm going to really rebuild our relationship and your relationship to other people. And that's what all this reconciliation of man in salvation is, and that's the model for our reconciliation in every other relationship with other people, including marriage. So that it's as Christ loved the church and as he did this, so a husband should do this and do that. So we've got the model clearly there in the reconciliation of man to God in Christ. And that marriage relationship between God and his bride, the church. But you see, you don't have that with two unbelievers, and it's even worse because the Spirit of God is at least in the one party, as Paul's pointing out here in 1 Corinthians 7 and so on. So I think there would be all the reasons for holding the marriage together that are given by Paul, that the unbeliever is going to have at least have the gospel there and is sanctified, set apart, in a privileged position, so on. The children otherwise would be unclean. All these reasons are no longer reasons at all. So it seems to me that certainly 1 Corinthians 7:15 applies, though I still might put that, it seems to me, in there.
Questions and answers about divorce and remarriage are continued on the following cassette.